Betrayal at the King Power Stadium and upheaval at Stamford Bridge as the last days of Jose Mourinho seem upon us. Or are they? That's what we're going to be talking about on this, the midweek preview show of the World Soccer Talk podcast. Welcome, everybody. I'm Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. And by us, I mean Lawrence McKenna, my longtime co-host and one of the newer voices on the show, Nipun Chopra. In the second half of the show, we're going to talk about the weekend's fixtures, nine matchups heading into Monday's game, the headliner, Arsenal hosting Manchester City. But for now, let's talk about the news that's covering all the broadsheets and tabloids in England. Lawrence, what's the fervor like in London right now? According to our co-host Kartik, who is traveling through there on the way to India, everybody is a little bit preoccupied with the special one.
Yeah, they are.
which doesn't exactly make you happy, probably.
I'm so bored of it. Today, all I was surrounded by was people going, there's a meeting, you know. And then the next minute, they sort of went, I don't think they're actually meeting. I think they're having a Skype session.
They're just recording a podcast like we are.
Well, this is the thing. There was a discussion then whether they'd use Skype or Google Hangout and whether they'd accidentally make it like some sort of public Google Hangout and then people could just log in and out. Frankly, no news is good news in Chelsea land. But the problem is that no news is also good news for journalists because it means they can just sit around and go, you know, I think he's having a meeting. The problem is we don't know if the board meet every week on a Tuesday or a Wednesday we don't know.
That's a really good point, because through the first couple of days of this week, we had Jose's reaction on Monday in the wake of Chelsea losing 2-1 at the King Power Stadium. And then it seemed like 48 hours of speculation in Poon until we finally seemed to have some hard news today. Various sources, the Times maybe the most credible one, although there were a number out there that cited actual sources, anonymous, of course, but saying that people were talking about Jose Mourinho and his viability for the job. So kind of to hit on Lawrence's implicit point, do we have anything new to talk about, or is it just another round of speculation regarding Mourinho's job?
It's just another round of speculation, because talking about it would be, I think the real conversation we should have is the fact that if they weren't talking about his job at this moment, you would
be talking about not talking about it.
Yeah, let's talk about not talking about his job. It would be really depressing as a Chelsea fan if his position isn't at least being considered, or at least some changes being made, whether it's changes in the way he attracts personnel, or actually he doesn't make those decisions, we know at Chelsea. But if they aren't having those decisions, that's the real story. So to me, it's mostly a non-story until we get some sort of conversation as far as a real link to him leaving. Because I think everyone, all of us in different podcasts have said that this time is coming, but it's been put off. And is it finally changing? As you started the episode, is it? I don't know.
Well, I mean, everything does change. Obviously, in time, things will change. Yeah. Today, I spoke with a Chelsea fan for another podcast. And that Chelsea fan said, everyone is 100% behind Mourinho. And then I said, yeah, but would you back Carlo Ancelotti? And they said, well, I'll back anyone who's in blue. And I sort of thought, you know what? Like this,
just like they backed Rafa Benitez, right?
Well, no, that was a different question.
That was a different shade of blue.
That was a very different shade of red. And then the problem with that was that then they said, well, you know, we're 100% behind it. But then, I don't know, I never get when fans go, well, we're 100% behind whoever it is. And I don't understand that.
But you kind of get it in this sense, because Mourinho has such a special place in the history of this club and he's established that connection with the fans. But then you hear about one alternative that I think is very viable that the Telegraph is reporting this evening, that, you know, the old standby Goose Heiding will be called in and he'll probably win the FA Cup with them, and just like he did before. And then this offseason, Diego Simeone will be targeted to come over from Atletico Madrid. And when I saw that report, I scratched my head for half a second before going, yeah, no, that sounds like a very Chelsea scenario. Now I think Jose is actually doomed.
But that's exactly what you're saying there, is that this is a Chelsea scenario, and that's terrible that you're saying it's a Chelsea scenario. What we should be saying is, what great longevity this multi-billionaire has built up at this club. Not, look at all the short-term angst that's going on today. And I think that's the biggest problem, is that we're talking about Jose, but that's almost a whole distraction to everything else that's more important at the club. They're not fielding any youth. They've got a load of players who aren't happy there. They've paid so much money for all these players. they just a ridiculous list of problems that you expect after a decade that an owner with so much money and what seemed like a clear vision for the kind of football he wanted would have at least implemented by now. But the fact is that actually Abramovich, for all his success, is actually a bit of a failure of an owner.
Ooh. But is he, though? I mean, I see what you're saying. Okay, so look at it this way. I mean, he's totally changed. In some ways, he's changed British football. He has
single-handedly. Doesn't make him success.
No, no, but let's look at his legacy. We're talking about whether or not he's a success, right? Chelsea has been the most successful European team in the last 10 years in England by far. I mean, of course, the bar is set pretty low, but they're consistently the best.
Manchester United made three finals and won one in the last 10 years. But I see what you're saying. Like, Chelsea has had a run of form that makes them on one level an unquestioned success.
But then the point would also be, someone said this to me before I started a show the other day. They said, I just look at the league table. And I literally turned to him and was like, then why the hell are you here? Like, your job doesn't matter then. So, because when an analyst turns to you and says, well, does anyone in history ever remember things? And I was like, that's the whole point of you being a journalist, is that you're journaling things so that we get more from this. You're writing a journal of the things that happen. Otherwise, every week, the newspaper would just be the table. And then we wouldn't need this podcast or anything else.
Well,
and that's the whole point about that.
Mourinho's viability right now is based on people remembering beyond this year. If people didn't remember things, Mourinho would already be fired. So it seems like a little strange way to look at things. But Nipun, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, can we in some ways look at Chelsea's legacy in the last 10 years since Abramovich took over as the Real Madrid model, where it's been used in throw away, essentially. And unfortunately, as much as I hate to admit it, it has been a success in those terms. But I get what you're saying, Lawrence. It's not that Chelsea is bringing through players. I mean, their most highly touted talent was Josh McEachran, and I have no idea where he is now. So in that sense...
Well, lost his cheek, but...
Yeah, okay. But
even then, I can answer that. Because in the past, people say, well, the winner gets to write history. Because at the time... people chronicling those things or whatever, you know, there was very limited space, a very limited amounts of people journaling that. Now there's unlimited amounts of people. There's a Chelsea fan channel, there's a Liverpool fan channel. So your success is, it's fantastic that you're saying that Chelsea is successful, but at the same time, how many times do people, and how many times when someone says, oh, we won the league, do people go, no, you bought the league?
Oh, every year and, now.
So how much success is that? Because when people go, like, people are like, oh, football's about the bragging rights. It's about this, it's about that. And, you know, I learn so much. And I think, you know, I think we've got a terrible cocktail of the past, which was your club is your identity. Like, you travel with all those people. The people out on the pitch represent you. And suddenly they're disconnected and there's no one on the pitch that represents them, but they still feel utterly connected to the idea of being part of Chelsea Football Club. And this billionaire has just flown in, completely rebranded everything, changed it to a club that defines itself by success, which it didn't do in the same way when he bought the club, even though they talk about being in the Champions League at that time, so they weren't winning it. And so it's completely changed the timeline and narrative and all the things, all the nuances that are important. So essentially, it's just a Premier League ruled by tyranny.
But what you're talking about aren't things in a vacuum. I think what you're referring to, Lawrence, are things about that have changed in football across the board, not just at Chelsea. And it's amazing to me that I'm the one defending Chelsea as much as I.
But I don't criticize. Understand. I don't understand why it's a criticism. Why it seems a criticism that I'm saying, like, look at more than just the league table.
Oh no, we should. I'm just saying it's more than just Chelsea, though. The things that you're outlining is true of Man United, it's true of Liverpool, it's true of every club, really, in the Premier League. It's the fact that... Go ahead.
That's the problem, is that actually there was there's hegemony to go before that. But with Chelsea, there is... The biggest problem for them is that it happened in such a short space of time.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
What I'm getting from what Lawrence is saying, too, is that Abramovich in the present, in the recent past, has fueled unprecedented success for this club. But what has he built for tomorrow? Like Lawrence is saying, not very many of the youth academy products that tend to be kind of disproportionately touted because of the fervent nature of Chelsea's new fan base. They're not breaking into the team. They have no stability as a coach with their manager. Their squad is aging. They don't have players that are coming in. A lot of the players that they do buy end up going out on loan, maybe never seeing full a full season with the senior team. So whereas a team like Manchester City has spent prodigiously, there is a kind of this admirable continuity to it if you're into continuity. But one of the reasons people should be into continuity, Nipun, is that it kind of builds for tomorrow.
Yeah, and City has done a good job, right? They've invested in their youth academy. They've invested in a new a youth stadium, in fact, if I remember, youth facilities and youth stadium that they're building and will be ready in the next 3 or 4 years. So there's truth to what you're saying. There's a difference in the way what City is doing now versus what Chelsea did in 2005, 2006, where they literally just bought a new team. Yeah, so I see what you guys are saying. My overall point is that some of the criticism that we are leveling to Chelsea might be more of how we feel as maybe old school fans about the things we loved about football, but we see that changing across the board, I think.
I don't know. I feel like there's Chelsea set themselves a yardstick, and there's a lot of people looking for authenticity and those kind of things. And I feel like Mourinho bought a lot of that authenticity because of his background, all those things. But now that those things are essentially being taken away, it's very hard to fill that with something that actually has any meaning apart from, oh, look at this Russian that did this. Yeah, and it's good. That's really empty, and that leaves you with a really horrible feeling that I know, almost like when you realize Santa's not real, almost.
or you realize any 10 years of your life are replaceable with any other 10 years. Like this decade of Chelsea becoming a prominent team at the top of the English Premier League table, well, another team is going to be a prominent team in the next 10 years. Your 10 years that you thought were special, they're not special. There are no special 10 years. Right. Wow,
suddenly
we got really
existential
here.
You're alone in your bedroom talking into a mic and just two other guys in America and you don't know what's happened in those 10 years.
Before Lawrence breaks out the razors, let's talk about... I want to talk about two things that actually seem to change the story this week. And I want to ask you guys why they changed the story, because I just don't quite get it. The first thing is the actual result from Monday. We had a team that was 1 point above the drop go to a team that went to the top of the table and lose 2-1. Nipun, I don't understand why that should change Chelsea's story. Why is a team that's struggling, unable to win on the road at one of the best teams in the league, a game changer in this narrative?
I think the biggest reason, Richard, is that you've already been replaced in my mind, Richard.
But it's not close enough.
I think the big reason for me is that one of the big defense that Chelsea has had of the way they've been playing and Chelsea supporters have had is that they've been fairly devoid of creativity and devoid of the kind of players that Leicester has had, in form players like Leicester has had. So I think in that sense, when you see what Leicester did to them in that game, for me, it's a point of contention almost to bring back the idea that Chelsea is in the relegation zone. It's just surprising, I guess, and I cannot make sense of why Chelsea is where they are, and a lot of us are trying to make sense of it. And as you and I discussed when we reviewed the game, the big issue for us is that Mourinho doesn't know, so none of us are really being able to put our finger on it.
I think he knows. I think he said it today. The players are just playing bad. Sometimes it's just that. You look at these players, they're not good right now. Yeah. I think
that's not what you're paying them for.
Right.
And what you pay for. You pay for consistency, and you pay for them to be, well, at least professionals.
Yeah, I think Cesc Fabregas would agree with you, right?
The irony of Cesc. Yes. Being the one
well,
that said that.
At least he's being humble, like Mourinho has asked him to, and kind of looked at himself and asking his teammates to look at themselves. Lawrence, I want to ask you about this next one, because I'll go ahead and confess my bias here. I was really annoyed by the treatment of this. Mourinho, after the game, in his interview at King Power Stadium, said that he felt betrayed by his players, saying that the tactics that he had implemented before the match weren't implemented. He didn't name specific names, but it seemed like he was talking about Cesar Azpilicueta allowing Raheem Mahrez to shoot on his left foot for the second goal, and the team allowing Raheem Mahrez to cut back on his left foot for the cross that went for Jamie Vardy's goal. I want to get your thoughts on that because, well, mostly I'm hoping that you can shed some light on why people were so upset about somebody for whom English is a second language, not quite getting the use of the word betrayed 100% correct.
Did he look confused when he said betrayed? Because I think
he said betrayed, and then he said something along the lines of "if that's the right word."
Yeah, but he knew it. I think his grasp of English is big enough to know.
Right, that's the question. Is this just Mourinho being that devious?
He has a great relationship with a lot of journalists. I think Henry Winter said, you know, he knew that the word, as soon as he heard the word betrayed, he knew that Fleet Street was like, okay, yes, Jose, let me go away. But the problem would also be you can say things like, and maybe, you know, this is another use of English, my legs betrayed me. My words betray me. So you feel a little bit let down, but maybe you feel a little ill-equipped almost. So you're not necessarily blaming the words or blaming the item.
The players betrayed my plans is another way that he could have said that.
Yeah, and so I'd imagine it's more along that line in that, you know, essentially they didn't do my plan. But it's just such an interesting word to use because of, you know, the idea of a mutiny that is possibly going on at Stamford Bridge.
I can also see, as much as you're talking about Henry Winter imagining those typewriters, because Henry's not a young guy, imagining those typewriters going off on Fleet Street, I can also see the Chelsea locker room just shaking their head and going, this is why we hate the media. This is why we have this disdain for the coverage, because they'll take this one word and they'll just blow it out of proportion and try to use it against us. And it's still Chelsea against the world, because look what they're doing with that. Nipun, what are your thoughts? The Belgian media has done that. The Belgian media has?
Apparently, the Belgian media today was saying, making it very, very clear that Hazard had betrayed Jose.
Perhaps. Gentlemen, I want to draw one other parallel here before we go to break. A few years ago, last year, Rafa Benitez, we saw Liverpool fall out of the top four, what we thought was an impenetrable top four at the time. And then 2 years ago, we saw Manchester United do the same thing in the first, not full year, of David Moyes. When are we going to get used to the idea that these teams at the top aren't granted a spot, aren't just allowed a spot infallible. At the top? Yeah, why they're infallible, they're indestructible. Nipun, when are we going to get used to the idea that this old Big Four model, that in fairness had been the Big Four for years,
right.
When are we going to get used to the idea that that's antiquated?
I think we are getting used to the idea that that's antiquated. Leicester City is a perfect example of that. We've had other examples in the last 3 or 4 years of teams making a run into out of nowhere. Southampton being in third place, I think, as late as October last year and maybe November last year. So I think we are getting used to that, but it's a little bit different because how late this Leicester City story is going. Having said that, even though we are getting used to the fact that the technical, you know, traditional first four idea is antiquated, at the end of the day, will the same front four end up in top four? Maybe Chelsea won't be there, but it will still probably be four of Man United, Liverpool, maybe Spurs, Arsenal, and City. So how outdated is it as a whole season? But I think it is outdated as far as soon as the season starts, we predict the four right out of the back, which is always wrong.
And Lawrence, you've seen the trouble Liverpool has had reasserting itself in the top four. The 1 year Rodgers took them to second place now looks like it was a best case scenario as they're now struggling to crack that top four. Do you see anything in Chelsea that reminds you of that fall that Liverpool had under Benitez and then Hodgson?
Well, I guess what I see in that is the temporary nature of a lot of the problems, but the fact that when something terrible happens, it seems so permanent. When something brilliant happens, it can seem so fleeting. And maybe there's some sort of happy medium between the two. And actually, how quickly things have changed at Liverpool under Klopp is ridiculous. So, you know, I think Liverpool fans are very aware of how quickly things come and go at the moment because, you know, it went for 20 years and then came back for a little and then went for another five or however long. So, you know, I think it also depends on your perspective. And I think Chelsea fans, and I think Chelsea as a club, saw and internally see themselves as somewhat of an infallible body. And I think other clubs have different approaches, slightly more down-to-earth ones maybe.
Had to take a break after that one. Lawrence, I'm just now remembering how before I joined the show, when it was just you and Kartik doing it together for a while, how I used to think you were...
Please don't say it like that.
when it was just you and Kartik doing the podcast for a while. I used to think that you were in your early 40s because you had this perspective on things that was so much broader and so much more philosophical than somebody like me. At that time, I was in my early 30s. And I thought it was so great that Kartik was working with this venerable man from England who can provide a completely different perspective from our detached Americanisms.
It was so sweet of Carl to get the time to do that charity work.
He was really patronizing you the whole time.
Yeah, it really was.
We're going to jump back into England in a second, but there's another big story that has... I hate to even approach it like that because it's another issue where we're not sure if this is a story or not, Nipun. We have seemingly some news from Pep Guardiola about his future at Bayern Munich and his potential future at Manchester City, Manchester United, Chelsea, who knows? But the news is only that... he's going to have an announcement next week. He and the club are going to have an announcement during the winter break. But of course, we have reports on both sides of this now. Some people saying he's gone. Some people saying he's going to sign a two-year extension. What's your read on it?
My read is that I think it's more likely that he will stay. I know Lawrence has a different opinion on this. But I think for Guardiola, he's done a terrific job at Bayern. He came into a job that... one of the toughest jobs anyone could ever have coming on the background, on the back of a treble winning season, and has made Bayern play in a slightly different way. In my opinion, Guardiola is the best manager in the world right now. I know he has some detractors who say stuff like, oh, when has he ever managed a club that hasn't had great players? Which is, kind of a silly argument when you consider that. The fact that he hasn't managed at a lower club doesn't mean that he wouldn't succeed at a lower club. Anyway, point being, I think with Guardiola, I think he will stay at least for another season. Maybe it won't be a two-year contract, but he has everything at Bayern right now. Maybe that's the only thing that will make him want to move on, kind of like at Barcelona. He might have just felt that it isn't enough of a challenge. So that's the only reason I can see him leaving.
We lost about 30. Well, we didn't lose it, but we had Skype gremlins crumble some of your answer there, but we got most of it. Lawrence, Guardiola.
You didn't miss much.
Lawrence Guardiola, why don't you talk to us about the nature of coaches and the underlying fallacy of changes in the modern football world?
I would love to, Richard, but you don't give me enough time. Where's Guardiola going to head next? I guess is the big question. Most people in Germany assume it's England for good reason, probably, because Guardiola stated that he would like to go to the UK, apparently. A lot of people close to the club, people like Raphael Honigstein and people like that, have been writing articles. And there are other people who believe that Pep will move on come the end of the year. I think a lot of people believe that it also probably, like you say, isn't not enough of a challenge in many ways for Pep. The interesting thing for Pep is Pep could coast for his entire career, just picking places he wants to go, you know? Mm-hmm. But he obviously hasn't done that, even though some people seem to think that it's easy to coach a high-end team. And that it's just, you right. just kind of get there, you just kind of turn up. But anyone who even played like half an hour of Football Manager knows how difficult it is to even do that. So I don't think that he, you know, I don't underestimate him. I think he's perfectly capable. I guess the question for me is what he's looking for as a challenge next. Right. Is he looking to build something that's his own? Is he looking to work with someone like Arsene Wenger, which will clearly not be just his own project? Is he looking to shape a Man City-esque kind of thing? Or will he do the normal thing that he normally does, which is go to a Louis van Gaal team a few years after Louis left? I think there's a lot. He has big choices. And then he also obviously has the choice of, would he go to Chelsea, where he will just, you know, he'll be venerated because they basically, Roman tried to build the club for him. Hmm. And then, you know, in many ways, the outsider of Mourinho came in and filled that void again. And, you know, they're still not, neither body is still fulfilled. I think there's a lot there for Guardiola to pick over and work out where he wants to go. Where do you guys think? I personally would go against, I'd go against going to City. I'd go to United.
I would love for him to go to United because we could then be left in this world where Liverpool has Jurgen Klopp, Chelsea might have Diego Simeone, Manchester City keeps Manuel Pellegrini, and Manchester United has Pep Guardiola. Now, if you were to make
a list, have Ranieri.
There you go. And Arsenal still has Arsene Wenger. Now, if you were to make a list of the top 12 or 10 head coaches in the game. England's going to have a lot of them on that list at that point. I think that's something Lapoon and I were talking about last week. Maybe another Guardiola, another Klopp, a Simeone would help solve some of the mediocrity we've been complaining about at the top of England's table.
How many of those guys are ex-Barcelona there?
I'm not sure.
A fair few, but Klopp, really.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the top guys at the moment all came out of that Barcelona school. It's really fascinating. Yeah,
it's almost as if they have a huge effect on modern football. We'll have to look into that. Gentlemen, let's go to this weekend's action of the Premier League, the 17th round of the season. It starts on Saturday with West Bromwich Albion hosting Bournemouth, Stoke City, Crystal Palace, Everton hosting Leicester City, Manchester United welcoming Norwich City, Chelsea is hosting Sunderland, Southampton hosting Tottenham Hotspur, and in the late game on Saturday, Aston Villa is visiting Newcastle. Two matches on Sunday with Liverpool going to Watford and Swansea City welcoming West Ham United. And then on Monday, the big match of the weekend, Arsenal hosting Manchester City. Unfortunately, we're not going to talk about that one at all because the three of us are going to be back on Sunday and we have four whole segments to fill and we're going to need that one to fill one of them. But when you look at the fixture list for this weekend, the relegation fight really takes center stage. We're talking about three matches that really jump out between potential relegation battlers. West Brom hosting a resurgent Bournemouth, Newcastle resurging themselves, hosting Aston Villa, Chelsea versus Sunderland. Nipun, I want to start with you because when we were going through our notes, you noted how funny, or I guess some people would call this ironic, but it certainly is strange that Chelsea, the defending champions, are now amongst these relegation battlers, and it's not even a question about whether they should be here. They just are here.
It's just every time we talk about Chelsea and a relegation battle, I always chuckle because it just seems so absurd, and it's happening every week. Every week, I wrongly predict that it will change, and it doesn't. I'm going to predict again that it's going to change. And it, because the reason I predict that is because Mourinho has never lost to Allardyce. I think he Chelsea's won 18 out of 21 against Sunderland. So I'm going to predict again that Chelsea's going to win this. But let's be honest. I mean, you cannot put anything past this Chelsea team right now. It is absolutely possible that they drop points in this game and end Allardyce's losing run against Mourinho.
Lawrence, two clubs with two match winning streaks, Newcastle hosting Aston Villa, Bournemouth with the tougher challenge going to visit West Bromwich Albion, a team that has put together four straight results, 6 points, I believe, in those four games. The likelihood of those two teams pushing their win streaks to three.
Yeah, I think there's this kind of, everyone's obsessed with the managers who have come in and started pressing, but there are actually this kind of body of teams who are not doing that right now. And they're almost anti-pressing. And it's really entertaining to watch because actually they almost negate what the other team do. But instead of us just sort of going, oh, well, a lot of people say it's boring. Instead of people just sort of go, oh, it's incredibly boring. It's sort of like, oh, suddenly it's clever because they can kind of, you know, you thought pressing was the ultimate answer and now it isn't. And the problem is what happens when two teams meet who everyone likes. And then that's where Bournemouth come up against West Brom and then everyone's done because everyone wants Bournemouth to win, but West Brom are just blatantly going to come out with a win.
I tend to agree with you on that one. And then the other game, I want to say that Newcastle is going to extend it to three because Aston Villa is terrible, but would anybody be really shocked if Remy Gard gets his first win at a Newcastle team that has been wildly inconsistent this season?
I was gonna say, I had this conversation today, it was like such a Newcastle thing to do that they're like, yes, got those guys, oh, the villains.
Yeah, especially with a bunch of players that maybe like, okay, we can sit back, relax again. We're not on edge anymore. And then Aston Villa, who to their credit have been playing hard lately, maybe just outworks them in this one. Maybe that's a trap game for Newcastle.
Can I really quickly share one of my favorite footballing memories because it includes both these teams? It was 8 years ago when Lee Bowyer and Kieran Dyer actually got into a fist fight. Oh, God. Playing for Newcastle against, and both of them at the time were playing for Newcastle. So
it has been too long since we mentioned Lee Bowyer on this podcast. So thank you for that, Nipun. Your contribution as well.
Loves the Lee Bowyer drop.
Boy. Let's talk about the games at the other end of the table. And much like the last 2 weeks, we're not getting a battle of two teams competing for the title. Probably the most competitive game on the list I just read is Watford versus Liverpool. Again, putting Arsenal versus Manchester City aside. For the nine matches this weekend, Lawrence, it again looks like teams are going to be challenged not to slip up. And over the last two weekends, the teams haven't been rising to that challenge.
Still don't think that the slip up thing works because in this league, and when it's so competitive, it slip up by the standards of a 2005 team, if that makes sense.
Well, slipping up is slipping up.
Yeah, I guess so. But then what I'm saying is because of the tactics United? That Liverpool... Yeah, but also because of the tactics that Liverpool choose to play or because of the tactics that Spurs choose to play, there's a strong likelihood of them...
Or they're coming off short rest because of Europa League. They're slip-ups that maybe are explicable, but they're still slip-ups.
But I think the thing is that this Watford one would be explicable.
Absolutely.
Because Watford love a good long ball. You know, they've got two strikers up front that are going to boss that Liverpool back line. And Liverpool's pressing isn't maybe not going to do the job against a side that wants to sit deep. And Liverpool have benefited from essentially being the away team when being away, because for some reason people's perception of the away team is that they'll just sit back, which generally rarely happens. And then Liverpool have, you know, played the away team essentially. Now Watford are playing the role of the away team, but at home, and Liverpool are going to have to come up against that, and they're going to have to. The challenge is going to be break them down, and then you come up against Dini and Ighalo. What do you do?
Yeah, Nipun, let's stick with this one because what Lawrence is saying very much masks onto what Liverpool had to deal with at Newcastle, or what they had to deal with when Crystal Palace came to Anfield, and those are a couple of prominent losses lately for Jurgen Klopp's team. So why is this going to be different? Do you expect Liverpool to either play better or learn their lessons? And if they learn their lessons, how likely is it are they going to learn a lesson that deviates from Klopp's approach?
Well, I think there's definitely an issue with what Lawrence has raised as far as teams figuring out the pressing or playing, being able to play out of the pressing. And then what does Liverpool do against a team that's not, you know, allowing them to play the way they want to play? But I think there's also other issues with Liverpool, some stuff we talk about every week on my other podcast, and some of that includes Mignolet, some of that includes Lovren, who will be missing for this game, and then the fact that Sako's coming back kind of from injury. There'll be other issues, and I think the big one for me is the fact that I think Troy Deeney and Ighalo are one of the most exciting front two that the Premier League has seen in a little while, that play as a front two, because for a while we've seen a player playing behind another player or one up top or stuff like that. So an old school Troy Deeney Ighalo is a throwback to old school days of the Premier League, and it's great to see. But again, the thing is that for me, Liverpool is on paper a much better team than Watford. I think everyone agrees on that. And historically, Liverpool have done well against Watford as well. So I think Liverpool will edge this one, but it won't be a comfortable win, no.
Everton versus Stoke, Lawrence. Everton versus Leicester, Lawrence. Leicester coming off, I don't want to say a landmark win. It's certainly not a landmark win for the reasons that we talked about earlier in the show, but there is something about getting over this hump against a named team in the way that they did when they only drew Manchester United, and now they have to try to salvage that momentum and take it into Goodison Park. It seems like, I mean, not to use a cliche, but this could actually turn into a trap game too if Leicester doesn't bring that same intensity against an Everton team for all of their draws. They've got, I think, the fifth best goal difference in the league.
Yeah, and also that, I mean, Robert Huth is out for this game. I think that's a huge note for Leicester in this one, because, you know, for such a long time, they've had a very stable system sitting behind
and
the guys.
And Drinkwater as well, right?
Yeah, I was going to move further up the pitch towards Drinkwater, and the fact that the combination of the two there, and, you know, that basically the pairs all over the pitch, the twos that people seem to love playing, and, you know, Mahrez is fantastic, and, you know, suddenly everyone's making the conclusion, well, Vardy's good because of Mahrez. As if a through ball wasn't something that more than one player could play on the pitch. And I still think, you know, if they're lacking Huth, then you're looking at Lukaku down the other end of the pitch, and it's incredible what he's able to do against a back line when he's on form at the moment. So I'm looking forward to seeing all the matchups. I still sort of think what I'm looking forward to is basically, oh yeah, Leicester won again. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it seems like that's what we were saying come Monday. Just, oh, of course, this is how it goes. Stoke versus Crystal. Go ahead.
Really quickly, let me say, if Leicester were to win this game, you guys, they'd be top on Christmas Day. And in the last 6 years, except for Liverpool, every team that has been top at Christmas has won the league. So maybe coming back to something that you talked about last time, Richard, maybe then we can start talking about them as possible title contenders.
Do you think there's something magical about Santa Claus that causes teams to win titles?
Or just having more points at that around that time of year.
Yeah, perhaps. Or maybe it's because the Premier League tends to not have these huge multi-horse races. And usually if you
But race... the other confounding factor is Leicester's almost never won against Everton in the Premier League.
Mm. Let's go down this list. Stoke versus Crystal Palace, Manchester United versus Norwich. Those are going to be close games, but also stylistically, they might not be the best watches for you guys this weekend. Southampton versus Tottenham, though, even though this seems like a little bit of a mismatch, Southampton is gravitating towards the bottom of the table, Nipun. Tottenham is coming off of their first loss since the first week of the season, but generally have been a strong side. This seems like a game where Tottenham will really want to get 3 points, not only to get back into the win column, which they have been avoiding quite a lot recently, but yeah, also just as a proof of concept against a team that, while talented, has not been good of late.
Yeah, and Pochettino returned to Southampton, club he managed, and I think the key battle here will be Southampton trying to play down the wing and play the ball to Pele. And we saw in the last game that Danny Rose can, on his day, be a terrific a fullback, and then on another day, completely go missing. So it will be Danny Rose will have a key role to play in this game, both defensively as well as offensively. And I think with Spurs' defense having done as well as they have, we saw a great montage. I think it was Robbie Musto a couple weeks ago that showed how well Spurs' defense has been playing the offside trap as well as moving together. So as with that consideration, I think you have to give, for me, give Spurs the edge here, and I think they'll win 2-0 even.
Mm-hmm. Really quickly, guys, the match we highlighted most competitive out of that group, Watford versus Liverpool. Nipun, who wins that one?
Oh, that one, Liverpool.
I got a 1-1 draw. Lawrence?
I'm superstitious.
Well, everybody, come back on Sunday so we can see if
5-0
Lawrence is...
Oh, sorry.
To Watford.
Oh, I've jinxed it.
So we can see if Lawrence's superstitions hold. But until then, for everybody at World Soccer Talk, for Nipun Chopra and Lawrence McKenna, I'm Richard Farley saying enjoy your football. The World Soccer Talk podcast is a production of World Soccer Talk and is executive produced by Christopher Harris and produced by Richard Farley. You can get the podcast a number of different ways, including Stitcher, iTunes, TuneIn, SoundCloud, and Audioboom, or you can go to worldsoccertalk.com to download the show directly. To get in touch with one of the hosts, you can reach out to them on Twitter. I'm Richard Farley. Kartik is KKFLA737, Lawrence is LOZCAST, Lawscast, and Nipun is Nipun Chopra 7. Don't want to bother with Twitter? Go ahead and reach out via email, richard@worldsoccertalk.com.